We moved out of caves and into human-built shelters a very long time ago. We know how to build houses and build some very fine ones at that. The knowledge that seems to escape us is how to get everybody into a house, or at least into a house they can afford. We've been working for a very long time to curb homelessness. We've been working for a very long time to build affordable housing that does not turn into slums. Our guest this hour focuses his attention on these issues in his book, Democratic Architecture. Donald McDonald is an architect and planner with more than 40 years of experience. His work includes the design of the new eastern span of the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. This edition of Democratic Architecture is its third. The book first debuted in 1996. Mr. McDonald has traveled the world observing approaches to housing in more than 80 countries. Donald McDonald, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
So I understand that your trips overseas to all these other countries involves both totalitarian and democratic societies. Did you find a bunch of places where they do seem to get affordable housing right?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting, one of the most interesting countries to look at is Holland. They've done an incredible job of housing everybody they can. And so I think that, you know, there are examples out there. The government has to subsidize a lot of it, but some of it, especially in our open areas and the fringe areas of suburbs, you can build pretty inexpensively if you can afford the land.
Is it a difference of what the government is willing to put out? I mean, when you look at expenditures from government in our country, is it vastly different as a percentage of the budget or percentage of GDP to what places like the Netherlands put out?
Yeah, I haven't really studied it that well. I just have a few friends that I worked with, and I was working with Greenpeace, who were working out of Holland, and they were living in these subsidized housing, and they were perfectly nice homes to live in, and there's a lot of things that make you wonder what's going on sometimes, because in Holland, education is very inexpensive, and like Scotland and Scandinavia and those countries, it's virtually free, you know, so you, at every level, you know, from university down to high school and so on. So there's something going on that we're not doing, and housing's sort of part of it, and I just think that we have the economy, we have the wealth, we have the know-how, and we need to somehow, you know, work a way to get that. And so this book I've put together, I've done a lot of non-profit housing in the Bay Area. And as you know, Jerry Brown cut out redevelopment altogether half a year ago, and that really shut down a lot of potential housing possibilities. And so there's a subsidization that goes on, but there's also building codes and zoning and elements like that that could be looked at in a much more what I call a democratic way, where everybody has a chance to get on the housing ladder. And in my book, I go from, you know, city sleeper right up to, you know, real high density, multi-level, say 7-8-story building. So the idea is to open it up to everybody. And I try to use examples that I've personally done myself. And in many cases, I decided to try it myself, where I became a developer sometimes, and I'd buy a lot and put up a very inexpensive house, and I'd sell it for, say, $20,000 to $40,000 under the market for the same square footage you get in another piece of property. So there's just certain things that could be done that aren't done. And I think that, you know, construction techniques, the size of the house, just a lot of stuff that can be looked at that really hasn't been the size of a lot. There's a lot of areas that, you know, you get a quarter of an acre for one house, you know, and you can actually put 5 or 6 houses on that lot. And so the idea is to someone get zoning where you can do things like that.
You do believe in a right to housing, is that right, Donald?
I absolutely do, yes. In fact, there's a real interesting article that just came out, I read in the paper the other day, that when you take a homeless person off the street and you give him housing and you don't sort of dictate his life that he has to go to rehab and all that, a lot of them bounce back, and it seems to work, just the fact they have a place to hang their hat. So it's an experiment. I can't remember. That's too bad I don't remember it right away, but it was in the paper. Just
housing first or shelter first, I think.
That was it. Yeah. Anyhow, the idea was to get somebody a place to, or they can clean up and have a place of their own, and then let them deal with their problems on their own. Don't have to dictate that they have to, you know, follow a certain guideline or they get kicked out. So, but it was interesting because it's working. A lot of cities, I understand, are starting to look at it now. So.
And it's interesting, too, in that it's being done in places that are poles apart politically. Seattle, for one, which is considered very liberal, and then the state of Utah, I guess, is doing a lot of it in the Salt Lake City area, which is the opposite end of the spectrum. So different ways to approach things.
Right.
So politics aside, though, I mean, you find some things that are undemocratic in home construction itself, the actual...
Yeah, well, the thing is that it's what I look at is that in our society, you know, everybody should have a fair chance at what they want. And a lot of developers, I'm not against developing or anything at all, don't get me wrong, but it's that the user should really develop his own space, okay? It shouldn't be dictated by an architect or an engineer. In other words, you need all those people to help you put it together, but to allow an open form and transparency in the process. And so when I work on all these projects, I always ask a nonprofit group to give me some representatives that the housing is going to be built for and let them participate in the design, just as you would on a single-family home, where the developer might anticipate the market, get a group together that are marketers, what they think the market is, and they'll go for it, you know. And so they study a lot of that. But my theory is to try and gather the users that would use it, you know, and let them participate in the design of it. It sort of knocks the architect's ego a bit when you do that, but it's the idea is to be a lot more transparent. So
not go looking for ways that are you know, people are going to go, wow, that guy's a great architect, but just, you know, something that actually works.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I'm an architect, as you know, and I have a good-sized ego probably too, but the idea is that I like open participation in the process. And in San Francisco and cities like that, you have to do it. There's just no ways to get around it. And for instance, I did a bridge up in Portland. The Silicon Bridge has been on that for about 4 or 5 years, and that was an incredibly open process. It was transparent, and there's a lot of community involvement, and it was a great example of this idea of allowing people to really get involved in their environment.
Really democratizing the process of architecture. And Tillicum Crossing, by the way, is the bridge that is for light rail, bicycles, and pedestrians, but no car and truck traffic. We'll talk more about democratic architecture with the author of the book, Donald McDonald, an architect himself, back on the Jefferson Exchange with Donald and you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the architect Donald McDonald, the author of the book Democratic Architecture. And it's not so much about the politics, it's about democratizing home design and construction. The book is now in its third edition. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about democratizing architecture. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, and by email jx@jeffnet.org. Donald, you go through some history of public housing in the book, and there's been public housing for a very long time. Very often derided as the projects. And here's where we use the quote fingers. I mean, what have we generally gotten wrong when we build public housing in this country?
Well, I can give you an example. It's, again, it's planners in the 60s in particular that thought they had the ideal way to live in a complex. So they developed a central courtyard, and everybody had to enter that courtyard to get into their unit. And so people could see what people were buying and taking into the units, and they could rob them. And so instead of approaching it like you do a regular city street where everybody enters their own home off the street and they have their own backyard, so there's a certain amount of privacy that's developed. And so in San Francisco and different areas, there's a lot of that went on. It's trying to individualize and privatize the area you're going to live in. So, you know, the neighbors can't watch what you're buying every day or, you know, what's going on. So if you notice, like in certain areas, I don't know what it's like up there, but when they're doing these things in urban settings, it was a sort of big super blocks. And so the idea was to, you know, group all the poor people together, which is not the thing to do. It's better to integrate them in the community. Like Enos Kane in San Francisco years ago, probably 30 years ago, had the funding for the project, but it was set up so that the developer could buy a lot in, say, a middle-class neighborhood and put 4 or 5 units, never more than 10. And he'd bring, you know, it's like families that could move in, the lower class families, you might say. And they would integrate with the community. Anytime you got much bigger than that, then that building became the source of crime and gang formation and things like that. So there was that. It went on for a number of years, and then it sort of died when redevelopment sort of came into play. But it was the sort of thing that I think is a way to deal with it. You don't put them all in one compound, you know.
You know, the compounds are pretty amazing. The book is illustrated. I should point that out to listeners who are thinking about taking a look at it. There's a photograph in the book of the Pruitt-Igoe complex in St. Louis, which is striking because it was built in 1957. But when you look at the way that Pruitt-Igoe, with these massive concrete blocks, tower over the surrounding neighborhood, it could just as easily have been Moscow in 1957.
You know, that's what's really surprising. When you go to Moscow, which I've been a couple of times, and you see the public housing, it's identical. And
wow.
What was interesting there is that when you go into these units, the person that moves into it, he's given, you know, the utilities, you might say, the sink and all that stuff, but it's all concrete. He has to finish it up himself. In other words, you'd get a concrete box, and inside it was nothing but what you'd make yourself, in essence. So, and a lot of the earlier ones that Corbeau did, or was influenced by Corbeau, people wouldn't even live in them anymore. There's, like, I was in St. Petersburg one time, and you go into these 1930s blocks, and they had common kitchens, and everybody shared in the kitchen and things like that. And the Soviets abandoned the dang things, you know. So it's pretty interesting, so...
It really is. Now we had Pruitt-Igoe is one of the Pruitt-Igoe, Cabrini-Green, I guess, and a couple of others around the country that just got infamous names,
right.
And ultimately ended up being demolished before they were very old. With the failures in public housing, you say attention turned to places like the Levittowns, and I know about this. I lived in Levittown, New York, until I was 13 years old.
Yeah,
this
true.
Is the boxes made of ticky-tacky that Pete Seeger sang of, but some things went right there, are you saying?
Well, the point was that there were starters. I think basically after World War II, you know, veterans came back and they had GI Bill so they could get educated. There's a lot of government subsidies to help these guys, which I think we should still do today, by the way. And so you could move in there, and those houses, a lot of them were 800 square feet. And when I discovered that, I figured, well, you can get a two-bedroom, one-bath house in 800 square feet. So I started designing those 20 by 20s and two stories, and I found a lot of savings in doing that, and I figured, and then I found families, say, like yours, that came out of there that were perfectly normal families. You know, size of the house didn't really matter, in a sense, it was the way the family is constructed and how it came together. So I used that as a prototype on what could be done and what was done, and we've improved that kind of planning a lot since then, but the idea was it was a great starter, I thought.
Well, contrast that, though, the idea of being able to put a family potentially of four people in 800 square feet versus the McMansions craze of before the Great Recession, where I was reading about people who thought 2,600 square feet for a family of three wasn't enough because they needed more room for their media center.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think that when you approach different levels of so-called housing ladder, you should allow some people that, you know, aren't in that class, that can't afford that, but allow them to have a house. So downsize the house. And I've designed one house that was 14 feet by 17 feet. It's really a studio, but it was designed so you can add blocks to it, so you could add four more blocks and bring it up to a regular size house you'd find in a suburb. But at least it got somebody in the door and started. They could even build a house on the weekends and then, you know, move in as it grows, you know. So anyhow, the idea is to get everybody in the door for the housing, make it affordable, and keep it small enough and construct it in a simple way so it is affordable.
So is that where we miss the boat, you think, a lot? We keep thinking in terms of what the middle-class person would want instead of what works, what's functional, what's utilitarian?
Well, I think where we are in Northern California, it's even past the middle class. I think there's bigger profits in building for the upper end of the market, you know. And my stepson, you know, develops at the high end, and the profits are totally different than going in and solving it for lower class citizens. And so my theory is that the developers don't bother those people because there's just no real profit in it, and not big profit. So it's sort of ignored market. Because like I said earlier, we got the technology and the know-how. It's just that there's no real big profit in it, so nobody does it. I'm generalizing this.
Sure. All right. Donald McDonald's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book, now in its third edition, is called Democratic Architecture, about democratizing the process of home construction and building. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 around the region, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You use the term paternalism in here, Donald. I mean, was that the attitude, you think, that led to public housing, this, like, we'll take care of you sort of thing?
Well, I think that what happened in a society where there's a lot of money floating around. You know, in the United States, we have a lot of nonprofits. We have philanthropy, you know, and they sort of pick up what you'd get in Canada, where the taxes pay for the roadway systems, the sidewalks. Where here a developer comes in, and when he develops a suburb, he has to put in all the streets and sidewalks. And in parts of Canada, the city does all that stuff, and then the developer takes over the lots. And so there's an amount of, like if you take Gates and people like that have these great foundations, they're putting money back in. And they're doing things that the government should be doing, And so in my mind, and so it's probably means higher taxes, but our medical care system's kind of got problems. And it's just there's a lot of things that taxes, if they're fair and they go across the board in a fair way, that you can have all these other things. And I'm going to hate to deviate a bit, but even with the infrastructure rate in America is really bad. And there's no reason for that because the technology's here, the wealth is here, but we squandered on many other things that I think aren't as important as our own livelihood in the United States. So.
When we should be building bridges and roads and railroads and that sort of thing. Got it. Okay. How much of designing lower cost housing comes from? I mean, obviously we're going outside just the realm of architecture here and into a little more of the social science. Is there a real interface between architecture and social science? I mean, when you talk about things like in a place like Pruitt-Igoe, everybody coming into the central courtyard, and of course everybody looks at you, was this found through trial and error, or did somebody actually apply some psychology, some sociology to some of the developments that have worked and the ones that haven't worked?
Yeah, there was a person that wrote a book in the 70s that I used as an initial primer for that, and it was based on housing in New York, and you're saying how when you have more than 10 units on a corridor, it becomes treated as a public street, and it's less than that, then it becomes part of your front yard, and you monitor it and sort of police it, you might say. And so that's where I took the idea that when I designed these complexes, I try to keep no more than 10 units on a corridor or a walkway or something to minimize the ability so that the public doesn't treat those interior walkways as a public street. So that's sort of where it came from. It's called Defensible Space, I think, was the book. But
okay.
It was a good book. He had done a real analysis, and it gave me statistical data to start setting guidelines to do, housing so that it was not gang formation or it didn't develop. And so there's stuff like that that was really important to when you go after this stuff. And so it did have a bit of a social bent to it, but I've never found housing where it solves social problems. The only example I've found lately, as I mentioned earlier, is that this homeless business, when you give a home or a space to somebody that's really on the street and they're off the street, and then you don't, force them to go to rehab and counseling and that they somehow pull it together, like 50% of them do, which is a big number.
All right, so getting people off the streets. When you write in the book though about high density housing as better in a lot of ways than single family suburbs, I mean it's a better use of resources. You don't chew up open land, things like that. But how much has to go on still to change attitudes of the people who could potentially live in lower cost housing? Because we're still sort of in a single family detached home picket fence garden kind of mindset, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that research I did a number of years ago, 80% of the United States people, want their own house and their own yard. And so what I've done to do that is like in San Francisco when I do projects, there's a 2-inch airspace between each house, And yet you have, houses that are $6 or $7 million and there's 2 inches between the next house and the walls between the next house. So the density, in my mind, isn't a problem in the way to live. You can still have a yard. It's just that the house would have to be smaller in a smaller yard, and I found that the yards that are really big, in many cases, they aren't cared for. And so if you both people are working in a family, you don't want a lot of maintenance, so you make smaller yards and smaller houses. And so that sort of begins to solving the problem of, how to deal with that.
You talk in the book too about infill, the idea of infill versus sprawl. Can you explain the concept of infill just a bit?
Yeah, infill is like if there's already a utility system or structure system of streets and electrical and water and sewer, and it's a derelict area like slums in many areas. Like Detroit's a great example where you can go right downtown and it's getting better now, but there's you know, green fields and roads and all the utilities there, but through the firebombing days, you know, 10, 20 years ago, it's starting to come back. But all the infrastructure's in place, so that's filling in where you can do it. And every city's got these blighted areas just about. So, yeah, I don't know what it's like up there, but in San Francisco, I have areas you can go into now, and they're tough areas, but at least you can go in and get started. In fact, when I was developing my own projects in San Francisco, I'd pick the marginal areas, and there are areas that were slowly being gentrified. And the way the process works usually is that when there's a, say there's a housing stock, it's happening in Oakland right now, as a matter of fact, if the sort of gangs control the area, the first people to move in usually are people that are single or, say, homosexuals, you know, people that are understand the structure that's there and they can live in and tolerate that. And once they start moving in, then the young families start moving in. And so you have a whole gentrification going on. And I've seen this process happen in Oakland, San Francisco, and Berkeley, and Emory, you know, these different areas. And so there's, and usually what we do then is we look at, you know, where the shopping or school is, and we try to develop, a, say, a 20-minute walk to a school or stores, and we do a circle, and then we find that's the area that where this gentrification is most viable. So, because it's better if you can walk your child to school than driving them, you know. So the idea is to find those areas, and we've done that in the past. So.
Donald McDonald's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Democratic Architecture. You can join the discussion at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Want to talk about, though, this idea of gentrification and the fact that it does happen. And so when you start talking about areas that were once gang areas or at least low-cost housing areas, and then as these areas gentrify, it drives the housing costs up and potentially drives the lower-cost people out, which I'm sure there are people who are saying, well, you know, good riddance to the gangs, whoop-de-doo. But it ultimately does remove parts of the city where the housing is cheaper. So how do you stop this from happening, for example, even when you're building newer developments and you're building houses for lower incomes to scale for those incomes to keep those from becoming trendy and nice and having people move in and knock those prices up too?
Yeah, it's pretty hard to do, to be honest with you, because I started doing these what I call starter houses in San Francisco and derelict lots, and I'd get a certain amount of lots and sort of tie them up, you know, where I could buy them down the line if when I had some money. And then I'd go in and put these small houses, and my theory was if the house is really small, it won't really go up in value, and it could be a starter for the next family moving in and in. And so I'd get a lot, and say the lot was zoned for three units, and an average developer would build three condominium units on and three parking spaces to go to the units in one building. And so I would build three little houses on it and separate them all and give them each a yard and a parking space. And I could sell those, you know, for about $50,000 under the going rate because I didn't have to put elevators in or double-loaded corridors or parking, concrete parking. In other words, I could deliver a product that they wanted that was a detached home with a yard and a parking space for well under the market because I took a lot, I subdivided the lot into smaller lots. In that. And so the thing is, what I'm pointing that out is that a lot of these cities have lot sizes. You can't put more than one unit on a quarter acre, for instance, in most of the suburbs. So the idea is to allow somebody to put four or five units on that quarter of an acre, you know, in just little houses, you know, and let those people come in and chop that. Anyhow, you get sort of what I call cottage zoning going on, mm-hmm. So those things can happen.
But there's resistance, and in fact, I can attest to it in my own neighborhood, right across the street. You know, there was resistance to the idea of putting a lot of smaller houses in on the lots rather than ones that were sized for the existing loans, but the existing zone. I mean, but you also take some quibble with building codes. You find them too stringent in some cases.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, there's, you know, if they don't want your little houses in the place, you know, the neighborhood will go against you. Then you got to go to the planning department, and you know, in other words, there's ways to slow the process down, and sometimes when I'd get in these battles, they'd go on for a year, year and a half, 2 years, and I had the endurance to hang in there and just work it out. But you know, it's any time you're changing a prevailing ethic, there's always a rough edges to it. And then once it gets going, what's ironic to me is that I went through a lot of problems with the unions and things like that because I was building non-union at the time to keep the cost down, and the unions went against me. And So I got some stuff firebombed. I mean, it's quite an interesting road just trying to get affordable housing for
wow.
a different group of people. And so the process is always pretty tough. And so when you try to break this prevailing ethic, you know, you have to be prepared for the downside, you know.
All right. We'll talk more with Donald McDonald in just a couple of minutes here on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Democratic Architecture. It is really about democratizing architecture to make things more affordable for more people so we can all get into homes. He does believe in housing as a human right. We'll come back and talk more with him. We have a couple of phone calls waiting as well. We'll take those and talk more with Donald McDonald when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the architect and planner Donald McDonald, the author of the book Democratic Architecture, about democratizing home construction so that more people can get into affordable homes. It's in its third edition out now. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Couple of calls waiting. Here's Dennis and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Donald McDonald.
Hi. Say, here's my question. I'm going to kind of use my family as an example. I have two brothers. I've lived in a 1,000-square-foot home for 45 years. I have another brother who has, and I raised two children in my house. I have another brother who has no children. He lives in a 2,500-square-foot house. With three car garage.
Right.
And then I have another brother who doesn't have really a place to live because he loves to travel. So he travels a lot and he goes where he wants. And when he's here in the States or here in Eugene, he just gets a place that suits him for that amount of time. And then he lives there and then he goes and lets it go and, you know, moves on. Usually rents or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see how that could be any more democratized. We all three have our own lives, and we all are happy doing what we do, and we all have the kind of housing that we want. I just don't understand. I'm confused.
All right, let's clear up the concept of democratic architecture in that sense then. Thanks for the question, Dennis. Appreciate it. Donald?
Yeah, I think that you're lucky to be in an area where you can do that. I don't know where you live, but you tried in San Francisco, and good luck. Or even Oakland is getting to be tough. So in the rural areas, it's a lot easier to find a place like that. But we're in San Francisco, it's a terrible problem right now. A one-bedroom unit runs for $3,000 a month, and, I mean, that's just normal numbers, you know, whereas you can get out in the suburbs or the rural areas, and you get $500 a month for a one-bedroom or something like that. So the problem, it's not everywhere, but it's getting housing for everybody. In your case and your brother's, you're lucky to have that set up, because I think 1,000 square feet is plenty of space to raise two kids, because a lot of the houses I've designed are 800 square feet, and they're two bedrooms, and sometimes there's three children in there. And nobody's unhappy about it, so...
In the case you know best, though, in San Francisco, is part of the issue there that San Francisco is so hemmed in geographically, it can't really sprawl out because the city is surrounded by water on three sides?
Well, that's one way to look at it. The other way is that we had Hunter's Point, which is hundreds of acres. It's just virtually flat. Now it's being developed, but it's sat there ever since the end of World War II. You know, so there's areas that people wouldn't build in because the developers were building in the high end. The only people that would go in there is the redevelopment agencies, you know, and their building programs, and that was shut down 6-8 months ago by Jerry Brown. So it's just that there's certain areas that in any city, you go to New York and you go to the Bronx or the different parts, and I went to school at Columbia, and you can go down to certain areas that are, you see them shooting drugs in the street, you know, so it depends where you live, but it's being answered in some communities. It's not being answered in others. And my theory was to take a hard look at everything and do it in areas where it's really tough. In San Francisco, it's tough, and I've done it in a lot of towns, you know, Petaluma and Santa Rosa and different places where we've done these small houses in densities that are 20 up to 30 units an acre, where everybody has a front door and their own backyard and a parking space. So those are the kind of things that suburban village is a term I use where, you know, you get, like, for instance, you take a shopping center, you have a lot of parking with nothing above it. My theory is to platform above that and put housing on top of that. And then, you know, you got a village because the essence of a village is already there. So, anyhow, but I'm just want the person to telephone in to realize there are certain areas where it's working.
All right. So, but the idea is mixed use. It sounds like you get a better neighborhood if you have stuff around where there's a grocery nearby or, you know, right, places people can shop, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
All right. So, is it at? Do you think we're making progress? Or are we sliding backwards as time goes on in democratizing architecture?
Well, I think that I think in the United States we've had areas where, you know, if you don't have a lot of money, you move into those areas. We have people in the recession from 2008 to about 2012, they left the city. They just couldn't afford it. In fact, a lot of them went to Oregon.
Hmm.
Portland in particular, I have three or four friends went up to Portland. It's just a lot cheaper to live. So there are areas where it's working, but it doesn't always work where the hot spots are, where, you know, the computer world's made everything incredibly expensive here.
All right. The book is called Democratic Architecture. Donald McDonald, its guest. We'll close a few minutes early for reasons I'll explain in just a moment. Donald, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.